You can stand at the top of the Empire State Building and look at the homes of 1/10 of the population of the United States. There are between 18 and 22 million people that make up the area that we know of as metropolitan New York. There are 8 million people in the place we call the Naked City. That's the five boroughs that make up New York City itself. But when you think about New York, you have to think about suburbia. You have to think about northern New Jersey, the most densely populated state in the Union, with 4 to 5 million people. You have to think about Westchester County with 800,000 people. You have to think about gigantic suburbs such as Newark, New Jersey, with 600,000 people. Or a suburb of Newark, such as Jersey City, with 300,000 people. Or a suburb of Jersey City, such as Union City, with 100,000 people. And we have no Southern Baptist work of any kind in any of this area. And when you begin to think of people, you have to think of this great metropolitan area. You could think of Boss Wash, which is that megalopolis, the city of cities that runs from Virginia to Maine, where within 400 miles lives 1/3 of the population of the United States. You could think about the Great Triangle from Washington to New York to Boston, with such smaller cities like Detroit and Cleveland and Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Baltimore and New Haven and Hartford, and on you go. And when we look at the cities, when we think of this great area where the people are, when we ask ourselves, where should we go? Perhaps the one great question that must be asked is, where are the people? Because that's the place where we must go. When we look at the city, it's easy for us to say, well, it's a great place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. And yet, the very reason that you would not want to live there is the very same reason that some of us must be there to tell about the one who makes life livable anywhere. Perhaps I could identify with you in the trauma of my decision to go to New York, because I was born in Texas at the place where my father was the pastor. But I was only 2 years old when we moved out to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I would really think of that as home. But I went back to school at Baylor and then to Southwestern Seminary, and while I was there, the people at Louisville, which is a suburb of Dallas, could remember when the little preacher boy was born, and so they went out on the limb and called me to be their pastor. And I served for 5.5 years in a little country town that overnight, when they completed an interstate highway, became a bustling, thriving suburb of Dallas. And it was a wonderful place to have a seminary pastorate. And when I graduated from seminary, as you fellows know, it throws you into a whole different category, because no longer was I a preacher boy, now I was a seminary graduate. And I began to notice out there nearly every Sunday, there'd be these little groups of people that would sit out there, very well dressed. They would sing all the songs without a songbook. They would take notes of the sermon, but they would never stand up as visitors. Now, those people stand out like a sore thumb. That's a pulpit committee. And I began to think, now, Lord, you're getting ready to move me someplace. And sure enough, there was a large church over in East Texas. If I were to name it, you would know it, with several thousand members. And they came to talk to me, and they said, the first question they asked, they said, are you a doctor? And I said, no, I'm not even a registered nurse. They said, well, you know, don't worry about it, because we're in a college town and we'll see that the college will confer a doctorate degree on you within a year. And this was just the place I knew I was ready to go, a very beautiful parsonage and a good salary and a lot of prestige and a large church. And it was just, I knew just the next stepping stone, you know, just the place to go to wait for Dr. Criswell to retire. And I was all set to go. Well, about that time, I got a call from New York. They said, would you like to come to New York? I said, it's a great place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. And they said, well, would you at least pray about it? And, you know, sometimes that's a very dangerous thing to do. The next Sunday morning, there were a couple of people from the church in our services, and I must admit that impressed me tremendously. And they said, don't make any decisions. All we want you to do is to come to New York and look over our situation. No strings attached, no obligation, just come. Well, I must admit now, as I look back, I think my motives were really bad, because I had already made up my mind where I was going to go, and I enjoyed a nice trip to New York, and after all, I had to be fair to them. They said, no obligations, just come and look over the field. And so I went to New York and landed back at Love Field on Friday, November the 22nd in 1963, and I was at Love Field when the assassination of the president was taking place, and I guess it was a couple of weeks before any of us could get our feet back down on the earth. But a couple of questions kept coming in my mind. And I really began to ask myself this question seriously in a way I'd never asked it before. And it's the question that every one of us have to answer. It is, what is it that God really wants you to do? I mean, what is it that God really wants you to do? And it's amazing when you answer that question how how things just turn somersaults. I mean, they just turn flip-flops. Things that you think to be success really just become unimportant, and things that you deem to be important suddenly become insignificant. And I kept asking myself this question: what is it that God really wants you to do? I tried to talk to everybody I could about it. Dr. Kenneth Chapin wrote me a two-sentence letter. He said, "Larry, it seems to me that some of us must go to where most of the people are. It seems to me that most of the people are in New York." Well, I talked to Dr. Criswell about it, and he'd put his arm on my shoulder and he'd say, "Son, if your heart will let you go." You know, what can you do? Well, I had another problem, though. I was like the man that had been invited by Jesus to the wedding feast. I had married a wife. Do you have things in your home that are not to be mentioned? I mean, you know, they're not to be a subject of conversation. You're not to discuss them. New York was like that. There was no decision to make. It wasn't even a live option. And I started praying, "Now, Lord, if you want me to go to New York, you've got to change that girl's mind." And this happened literally overnight, where one night we went to bed not even talking about it. The next morning she woke up and said, "Honey, I think we ought to go to New York." That was the green light, Christmas 1963. And for 4.5 years, I was the pastor of the Farmingdale Baptist Church. There are 8 million people on Long Island, 60 miles long. Somebody said it would be the fourth or fifth largest state in the Union. This was the first of our work. We had 8 missions running at one time. Some of our missions had missions. This is the spirit of the people there. And since July the 1st of 1968, I've become what we call the minister at large for the Metropolitan New York Association. Ken Lyle is our area director. I have offices in the Madison Baptist Church, where Charles Jolly is the pastor. And our responsibilities are in New York with some radio TV things and some youth work and a number of other things that we try to do in working with youth groups. And then to travel across the country as what Wendell Blue calls a roving cheerleader, to tell about the work in New York, as well as to have crusades and revivals, and a lot of revivals and crusades in pioneer churches, churches that maybe wouldn't ordinarily be able to have an evangelist. And I must confess to you that it's, you know, sort of what the young vernacular would say, my thing. And I don't know if I answer the question, where shall we go next? I hope that my next move will be to heaven, and I really hope that that's not any time too soon. When I come to think about people, wall-to-wall people, you have to think about, for instance, the 2.5 million people that speak Spanish in metropolitan New York, our work under the direction of Leobardo Estrada, or the 500,000 university students in New York City alone, or 55,000 people that speak French as Haitians in New York City. I could tell you about the Brooklyn Discotheque, where Larry Patterson is working, or Highland Avenue Baptist Church in Queens, where James Wright's sermon is translated into 7 different languages. I could begin to tell you about the work with internationals. I could tell you about Lefrak City, where there are 35,000 people in 6 square blocks, 20 34-story high-rise apartments, 600 families per unit. That'd make a pretty good-sized church right there. We can't get into these apartments, so the Home Mission Board has moved a young couple inside of one of them. We kind of work from the inside out. I could tell you about Co-op City, which is going to be inaugurated next year, where Freedomland used to be. There are 100,000 people that will live in 12 square blocks in Freedomland. The Ebbets Field Apartments, where the Brooklyn Dodgers used to play, has 5,000 people under one roof. Where the people are, our statistics show us that this is the great cutting edge of the growth of Southern Baptists now. 39% of the people are Roman Catholic, 36% are Jewish, less than 5% what we think of as evangelical Protestants, and 0.5% Baptist, and that's Baptists of all kinds. Don't let anybody tell you we are invading anybody else's territory. There's nobody there with a really decisive evangelistic thrust, and that's why we must be there where the people are. And yet, when we come to think about all of this, we can talk about our Metropolitan New York Association that now has 46 churches and 15 missions, and that's all happened in 10 to 12 years. We can talk about our new Baptist State Convention of New York with Dr. Paul James as our executive secretary. And the thing that keeps you awake at night in the midst of all of this fantastic growth is the stark reality that we have not even made a dent in the heart of the great metropolis. This is no time for backstore locations, for back alley locations or rented storefront buildings. This is no time to form U-All clubs where the Southerners can get together and over grits and talk about how things are down south. This is no time to have a stigma of being snake handlers or of surface negatives. And this is certainly no place where we can have a name that has a geographical connotation. It just won't be bought. There's no way. And lest you think that I'm only talking about my particular vineyard, let me throw this one at you. What New York is today, your city is becoming. With all of the dope, with all of the riots, with all of the strikes, with all of the inconveniences of life, that's where we are. And we hear everything in the world about Dave Wilkerson, the Crossings and Switchblade. We hear about Jim Voss or Jack Wurtzen, or we hear about Stephen Olford. And I thank God what he's doing through these dedicated men. But let me tell you something. These men are not doing anything that Southern Baptists shouldn't do and couldn't do with better resources and probably with better results. Why is it that we are always a dollar late, an hour late, and a dollar short in going where the people are? But I suppose the great dilemma that all of us face is being content where we are. And the question may not be so much as to where we are as to who we shall be. For indeed, it is not a question of geographical location. It's a matter of being Christ man wherever we are. It may well be that you've made a mistake in going where you are. But while you're there, be Christ man and be content even in that. I hear about people who are wanting to move all the time. And what it really seems to me is that they end up doing is just transferring from one part of the wilderness to another, still living on the manna of black-eyed peas. And perhaps the time has come where we can sense and realize that wherever we are, we will allow God to do his thing through us, and then geographical connotation doesn't matter. And somehow we've got to penetrate a community that does not welcome us and many times rejects us. And it is not a convenient or comfortable place to live, but that's where the people are, and that's why we must go there, because that's why Jesus came. And this is our responsibility. Listen, and I am finished. I heard of a woman in a high-rise apartment in New York City that had not been heard of for several days. A milk deliverer became concerned. They went to the super of the building, and with the police, they broke down the door. They found on the floor the nearly decomposed body of the woman, dead 4 to 6 weeks. On her desk was a diary open to the very last entry, and if you were to read it, you would find three words on that page. You could turn back the pages, and every single page you would find the exact same words over and over and over and over again. The lady simply said, "No one came today. No one came today. No one came today." And that story can be repeated literally millions of times in the place where people are alone in the midst of a crowded city. I pray that we who know of that one who came for us, that we will go to tell them of the one who makes life livable anywhere. Let's do it soon. Let's do it now.